from KQED.
Well, Steve Reich, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let me begin by asking you, I know that you were born in New York City and you grew up there and in California, but where were you and your family on 9/11? What were you doing and where were you?
On September 11, 2001, my wife and I were in Vermont, 300 miles away from our apartment in New York City, four blocks from Ground Zero. But my son, my granddaughter, and my daughter-in-law were in our apartment there. And at 8:30 in the morning, the phone rang in Vermont, and my son said, "I think they've bombed the World Trade Center again." It was bombed back in 93, as you probably know. And from our apartment, you can't quite see the towers because there's a building close to us that blocks the view. But you could hear, he could hear what went on, and he could feel it. So he said, "Turn on the TV." We turned on the TV just as the second plane hit. And that was pretty frightening moment because we thought there could be a third plane that'll hit City Hall, which is literally across the street from where we lived and where my son and family were. Then I told my son, "Don't hang up." Go into the bathroom. There's some masks I got from the hardware store. They probably useless, but put them on yourself, on the baby, and on your wife. We had double windows. Close both windows and don't go outside. Wait till our next door neighbor comes back home, because I know he was a very together guy and he had a vehicle. And so to make a long story short, my next door neighbor came home about 4 in the afternoon and did have a van and got his family and my family into the van and out of New York City. We came down from Vermont, drove everybody back up there, and we simply had to stay there for 30 days because the U.S. Army said no one goes below Chambers Street, and we were just below Chambers Street. 30 days later, we came back and lived in this stench that everyone remembers was hovering over New York for several months.
So fast forward to 2009, I think it was, Kronos comes to you. They asked for a piece with voices in it. Was 9/11 in your mind at all at that point or in their mind?
No, totally not. As a matter of fact, let's just a flashback. In 2002, I was working with Beryl on a video opera called Three Tales, which involved a lot of sampling and, of course, her video. And before that, we had done a piece called The Cave, which involved a lot of sampling. And before that, there was a piece called City Life, which involved a lot of sampling. A journalist shortly after 9/11, who was interviewing me as composer, said, "Well, are you going to do a piece about 9/11? Because they knew I had done, work with documentary material. And I said, to tell you the truth, if I one more sample and I'm just going to go to the hospital because I can't take that way of working anymore as a composer. The technical things involved just slow you down. I just want to write music for voices and instruments." And from 2002 to 2009, that's exactly what I did. UR variations, cello counterpoint, Daniel variations, double sextet, 2x5 mallet quartet, which is on the same CD as WTC 9/11. And that was just fine. It was exactly what I needed. I had no intention of starting to work with pre-recorded voices again until David Harrington called in late 2009. And when I told him, "David, I absolutely will write a piece for you," I did so because every time I work with Kronos, something really, really great happens, like Different Trains or a triple quartet. And I love working with them and I love them. And so I knew it was a thing to do, but I was a total blank. I had no idea. The only idea I had in my head was that the final syllable of what anybody said, whoever they were, would be extended out. So what you hear in the piece came from Boston, and that N is extended out quite a long time and then doubled by one of the string instruments and then going to L.A., and the A is extended out. That idea, as an abstract idea, to know those sentences would be the sentences, was in my head because I had the software to do that, and I thought, that's really interesting how to connect one speaker to another harmonically as well as what the content of what they say. And but no idea. And then what, 2 months or so down the road, God knows, it just like a light bulb in the cartoon, it popped in my head, wait a minute, I have unfinished business. 9/11, this huge thing that happened in my life, which is, an ongoing reality for all of us, was something that I should address. And now I've been asked to address something. This is it. And as soon as the light bulb went on, I immediately went to the net and to the public domain archives of the traffic controllers, NORAD, and the Fire Department of New York, and for which you do need permission, and it was very, very good working with the Fire Department on this. And then I decided that after I did that, I would speak to my friends and neighbors, having them reflect back 9 years later on what happened to them that day. And that's what happened.
Well, I want to play a little bit of the second movement of Steve Reich's WTC 9/11.
I was sitting in class, four blocks north of Ground Zero.
I was taking my kids to school. The first plane went straight over our heads and into the building.
Steve Reich, what did you want the music to convey when you married it with these voices?
I wanted it to convey those voices. that's really not a cop-out. It sounds like one, I know.
But there's a moment where it almost sounded like the inside of the airplane. It also sounded in parts like perhaps the airplane's going overhead. I mean, was that part of it as well?
No, it was exactly what I explained to you, but you were hearing the reality instead of the theory. I was sitting in class, four blocks north of Ground Zero, and the O. Now, the woman who's speaking is, I think, about 17 now, but she was just a kid in grammar school, and she's reflecting back to when she was a kid sitting in class four blocks north of Ground Zero. She was one of our next-door neighbors. The next voice is the voice of the composer and my good friend David Lang, and who is taking his kids to school. Now, David is a bass and has a very articulate voice. It's very clearly pitched. Flew into the building, and it's very – the word building is extended. And when you hear that, it sounds to you apparently like the inside of an airplane. It is definitely kind of a roar. But it's merely the actual voice of David Lang put through software that extends his final vowel. And this happens throughout the piece and gives the piece a kind of as if it was covered with smoke or atmosphere. And what it's also doing is connecting the previous speaker, who's, you know, the young girl who was sitting in class with David, who's taking his kids to school. They're forming chords, which are both stringed instruments, doubling the extension of the spoken voice, the final syllable thereof, which I think that's a perfectly fair comparison that you make. It could sound like the roar of an airplane. So in other words, by following this technique, which I was so I knew was right for this piece, things happen which were the consequence of simply following that musical procedure of taking everybody's final syllable and extending it.
9/11 brings up a lot of complicated emotions even today. It's still raw for some folks. We saw that when bin Laden was hunted down and killed. With that in mind, was there anything that you were hoping to either convey or avoid in composing this piece?
Well, it's certainly a minefield going through 9/11 subject matter. But 9/11 is not just merely people's emotional reactions to 9/11. 9/11 is just an event that was preceded by many, many other events, hijacking of planes and so on, and followed by innumerable bombings of London and Madrid and in India, Mumbai, and it could have been 42nd Street. It hasn't hit San Francisco yet, but you never know. There are lots of issues that are issues. The reason 9/11 is so important is that it's still going on. It's the banner headline of a story that's still very, very, very much continuing. So, yes, I mean, I there's a very clear example that will answer, I think, your question. At the end of the second movement, one of the women who was actually a wife of one of the members of my ensemble who worked in World Trade Center 1 and who that morning of 9/11 decided she'd take a little extra time for herself and just stay home and go and work a little bit later, says somewhat with a little bit of veiled, not so veiled anger, what's going to happen here? What's going to happen here next? Now, she's, of course, referring to what's going to happen next in New York City in the way of terrorist attacks. But, and I could have followed that along, But instead, there's a break in movements, and we go into the third movement, which is a totally different thing, and it says the bodies. What happened next was that the bodies had to be taken care of. So I'm consciously changing the direction in which the discussion is going and pointing to the third movement of the piece, which we haven't talked about. The third movement is built around the fact that in Jewish law, when someone dies, you don't leave the body alone until it's buried. Now, in 9/11, a lot of bodies simply were non-existent. And those that were remained, there were also mostly a lot of fragments, parts of bodies. And they were taken over on the east side of Manhattan in the East 30s. And there were some Jewish women going to Stern College in the 30s on Lexington Avenue, very close to where the hospital is. And they felt obliged to, it's called sit shmira, to stay and sit with these bodies in shifts rotating 24-7. It turned out for 7 months because there had to be all this DNA analysis to find out, you know, who really died? Whose body or parts of body do we have here? So when I read I read about this in the paper. I did not know about it until I read about it, and I was very moved by, you know, this is a very beautiful thing. These people, they have no idea who it is that they're sort of sitting in memorial for, but they're singing psalms and chanting psalms and singing parts of the Bible because they feel committed that's the right thing to do. And I guess that's why it was in the paper too. So I found two of these women who did this, one of whom turned out to be the previous president of my music publisher, Boosey & Hawkes, Linda Golding by name. And she's in the piece, and another woman who is now lives in Seattle but happened to come back to New York during the time I was making the recordings. And then finally I turned to Maya Beiser, the cellist, as you probably know, was the original cellist with Bang on a Can. She's now a well-known soloist. She premiered and recorded Cello Counterpoint. And Maya had done this practice for her mother when she died in Israel and had gone back and had sung and played the cello for her mother before she was buried, stayed with the body until the burial. So I asked her, would she, you know, sing one of the psalms, actually one line of one psalm for me, and she agreed. And here you hear her near the end of WGC 9/11.
You've collaborated with Kronos for 20 years. How is collaborating with them different from other musical groups you've worked with?
Kronos is a remarkable ensemble. First of all, they were a string quartet. They were a group of four people. When I first collaborated with them, Joan Jeanrenaud was the cellist, and she's a remarkable musician, a wonderful person. And we both talked about Hank Dutt. When we did Different Trains, which was our first collaboration, it turned out to be a milestone for both of us, by which I mean that it was something that I had. It was finally going back to pieces like It's Gonna Rain and Come Out from the early 60s, pieces which I emerged with as a composer, which were first came to public notice back in the mid-60s. And I finally was able to figure out a way to merge that kind of speech melody, just recorded, with actual musical instruments, and Kronos were the musical instruments. And working with them, Hank and Jean, who were playing viola and cello, had the job of doubling the voices. Every time a woman spoke, Hank would double her, and every time a man spoke, Gene would double him. How you actually work that out is by the bowing. What's an up bow, what's a down bow, according to the way the phrase goes. From Chicago, bum-ba-dee-dum, how are you going to bow that? And Hank worked that out, and we went back and forth. Well, yeah, that's the way. And working with them was just, I mean, the care, the attention to detail, the understanding of what's involved was just so phenomenal, so clear, so lucid, so dedicated that, you know, we all left feeling, you know, very, very moved by the whole experience. And then later, a triple quartet was, again, a different, no words, just music, but not one quartet, three, and very rhythmically charged, kind of probably inspired by the Bartok Fourth Quartet. And, again, a very successful and a piece I never would have written had it not been for working with them. There was an energy or an intensity, I think if you speak with David Harrington, you know very well of which I speak, that is transmuted into their playing and into working with them in a recording situation, which is just wonderful. It's just a moving. It's completely to the point. So when I was asked to write for them a third time, there was absolutely no hesitation. It was clear that I was going to do it.
Well, we're going to hear from David Harrington next, and I will ask him this, but let me ask you as well. What do you hope listeners go away with when they hear WTC 911?
Well, that's a question I'm asked a lot, and basically I have no answer for that. I mean, obviously, I want everyone who listens to any piece of mine to be extremely moved, maybe moved to tears. And I've always felt that way, and it doesn't matter which piece it is. And, of course, that isn't always the case. But it seems that there are enough people who are moved by what I do that, that people go and hear the music and want to hear it live and on recording. And that's a great great blessing. But there is no – when I'm writing a piece, I have to feel like it's really working. It's really working according to my intelligence as a composer, and it's really working according to my emotional reaction to it. And if it isn't, it goes in the trash. And my trash can is much bigger than my musical notebook where everything stays. What goes is bigger than what stays. So, it's the most important part of music, absolutely. And it's also the most difficult or impossible to speak about. As I've said to many people, but it's really the only answer I've got. When I'm writing it, I love it, and I hope you love it too.
All right. Steve Reich, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.